Ferris B'nai Torah presents The Shmooze, an engaging and motivating Mussar and Hashkafa series that deals with real-life issues.
In the end of Dvarim, the Torah is very lengthy, explaining that the Jewish nation has a very unique destiny amongst the Goyim. We are to be an Am Nivchar, a chosen nation, an Am Kodesh, a holy nation, and we are to be unique and act differently. And the Torah is very explicit that if we do as we're supposed to, then everything will be beautiful. You'll have Gishmechem be'itchem, you'll have your rain in your time, you'll be in your land, you'll be secure, you'll be healthy, you'll be well. Life will be beautiful. That's the Torah's guarantee, provided you keep the Torah. However, the Torah is also very explicit and very clear that if you don't keep the Torah, and then the Tochacha explains what happens. If you don't keep the Torah, and the Tochacha lists very graphically and very clearly all of the tragedies and calamities that will befall you one after another. And if finally you don't listen, it gets worse and worse and worse. And amazingly, at the end of this long string of horrific things that will happen, the Pasuk lays the blame to one thing. Why is it that all of this bad befell you? Why did it come to you? Tachas eshel ovadet Hashem lekecha, because you did not serve Hashem your God besimcha, with joy, ubitov levav, and with happiness, merov kol, from the abundance of good. Seemingly what the Pasuk is saying is the reason why all of these bad things happened, and again, horrific and catastrophic things, is because you didn't serve Hashem with joy and a gladness of heart from the abundance of good that you had. Now, I think it's rather obvious that something seems inconsistent, meaning our understanding of simcha is a nice additive to a mitzvah. If you're doing a particular mitzvah, you should do it with simcha because that's a maila, that's an advantage, it's a better way of doing the mitzvah. But here, simcha seems to be taking on an extraordinarily important significance well beyond what we would understand it. Again, this is because you didn't serve Hashem b'simcha. So the first question is, how in fact is simcha so integral, so important, that it's the pivotal point of causing the entire tochacha? And then it's even more interesting if you look on Rabbeinu Bachai on that pasuk. Rabbeinu Bachai, one of the Rishonim over there, explains as follows. What does it mean? Tachas eshel ovadet Hashem lekecha b'simcha, because you didn't serve Hashem with joy. Yashimenu akosuv, the pasuk blames you, the pasuk faults you. Bavaroso Hashem yisbarach, in serving Hashem. V'lahaisa avodah b'simcha, if you didn't serve Hashem with joy, why? L'fi shechayev ha'odom al simcha b'sasko b'mitzvah, because man is obligated in joy when he's doing the mitzvahs. V'asimcha b'maisa mitzvah b'fnatzom, and the joy that you have is in and of itself a mitzvah. Meaning, if you're doing a particular mitzvah, and while you're doing that mitzvah, you have simcha, not only are you giving reward for that mitzvah, additionally, that joy that you have is an independent entity. You're given schar for that separately. And therefore, says Rabbeinu Chai, besides the schar that you get for doing the mitzvah, you also get reward for the simcha. And therefore, Rabbeinu Chai says, a man has to be careful to do the mitzvahs with simcha b'kavana shlema. And then he says something rather amazing. He says that if you look in the Medrash Roots, it says that had Reuven known that Hashem was going to write about him, Vayishma Reuven Vatzelem Yodam, Reuven heard and saved him, B'ktefayim Alichol Aviv, on his shoulders he would have brought him to his father. Meaning, this is the famous event when Yosef was sold by the brothers, thrown initially in the pit. Reuven wanted to save Yosef, but apparently Reuven didn't go far enough. And the Pasuk, the Medrash is saying, had Reuven known that the Pasuk would have written about him, that he saved his brother, then he wouldn't have just had the idea of let's sell him as a slave instead of killing him. He actually would have grabbed Yosef, put him on his shoulders, and walked him to his father's home. And therefore, says Rabbeinu Chai, you see the importance of simcha. Now, the problem is that there's no connect. There's absolutely no connection between what he just said and simcha. As a matter of fact, what Rabbeinu Chai just described is a very common phenomenon. If I know that you're watching me, I'm going to act differently. If I know that I'm being observed, then my behavior is going to be very different than if I'm b'chadri chadarim alone. Meaning, had Reuven known he's being watched, obviously he would have acted differently. Had Reuven known that the Torah wrote about him, that he saved his brother, meaning he's being written up for the ages, obviously he would have been more motivated, he would have been driven, and that drive would have allowed him to do the mitzvah properly. But that's a drive from one of the most basic drives of a human. A person's sense of self, his sense of pride, you're watching me, you see me, that's a very powerful, powerful drive that has no connection to simcha, yet apparently Rabbeinu Bachai is saying that the two go hand in hand. So what I'd like to do this evening is see if we could get a little bit of a grip on what's underlying here, what's going on. But to do that, we need to step back a little bit. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to ask a question, but before I ask that question, I want to mention one thing. Typically, when I ask this question, there are three answers that comes to mind. The truth, and then three other versions of what you're really going to say before you actually think. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to ask you that when I ask this question, by the time I finish the question, I want you to immediately either speak out, or at least in your own mind, say the answer. No hedging, no what are people going to think, just answer the question. The question is, are you rich? Yes or no? Okay, now, I've asked this question in quite a number of different audiences to quite a number of different groups of people. Typically, in the back of the room, you get one person who says rich. And don't get me wrong, I don't mean, you know, spiritually, or I have a great family and I'm rich in friendships. I mean materialistically. Are you wealthy? Do you have a lot of money? And the average person will invariably say no. Okay, now let's circle that answer. And whether you spoke out your answer or not, in your own mind, keep in mind your answer. And I want to do some work and let's see where we're going. My grandmother was brought up in Eastern Europe. And she was a young girl during the First World War. And she described to me that she came from a well-to-do family. They lived in a house. It was a two-room house. Two-room house meant there was one room where the parents slept, and the other room where all the children slept, they did their chores, they ate, they cooked, everything else was done. Two rooms, that was the entire house. And believe me, the rooms were not large, and the family sure were. Now, why were they considered well-to-do? They were well-to-do because they had on their floor, they had wood. They had a finished floor, meaning the typical family in their shtetl didn't. Typical family had dirt for a floor. And the way the regular people, our great-grandparents, lived was in houses with cracks in the walls, without electricity, without running water, without heat, in very, very cramped, tight quarters. That's how the regular average person in Eastern Europe 100-odd years ago lived. We nowadays, if you go on vacation, try it one time, you go to the Motel 8 and you put the whole family in two rooms and you're like, it's cute and cozy for 2 days. But dream about living in 200 square feet, an entire family. Now, I had a Tanta Peril, my father's aunt, who came over to America before the rest of the family. And when the rest of the family came over, she said to my grandparents, you must see, you must see. She brought them into her apartment and she showed them something remarkable that they had never seen before. In the apartment itself was a bathroom. A bathroom in the apartment. Whoever heard of such luxury? And she said to him, you have to see this. Because keep in mind, even in America in the 30s, the typical tenement house, which is where most of our grandparents came over and lived on the east side, had a bathroom on the floor. That means if you had 10 apartments on the floor, it was a bathroom. And it was a cold water flat. We live in a starkly different world than that. I had a friend of my father's who was in yeshiva in Europe. And he told me there was no dorm in those days. He used to rent a little room off of another house. And he had a handy way of telling whether it was a cold morning or not. He would lift off the blanket off his head and look at the negelwasser that was lying at the foot of his bed. If the cup of water had an ice formed over it, he knew it was a cold morning. And if not, he knew it was reasonable. Now, gentlemen, let me remind you, water does not freeze at 58 degrees, nor at 42. It freezes at 32 degrees. I mean, the man slept in that room. Would you like to know what is the second largest cause of fights in marriages today in America? Anyone know? First of all, the real reason, the real cause of fights is no reason. Most fights about nothing. But everyone tells you the first cause of fights is money. Well, I believe that the second cause of fights in America is, where do we set the temperature to? 68, 72, no, call a rub up, sure, 70, right in the middle, right? Because we got to be comfortable. That man slept in a room that was 32 degrees, and it was nothing unique, nothing barbaric, nothing as like, who could live in such heat? If our heater breaks down and it's 55, already moving down the block to sleep by a friend. Now, just to give you another illustration, even in the rich land, the golden of Medina America, air conditioning was a new invention. Air conditioning was first introduced in the 50s. As a matter of fact, the only public places, certainly I would say in the late 40s and early 50s, that had air conditioning were the movie theaters. The movie theaters introduced something called air-cooled, and basically they would advertise that beat the heat of summer, come in to this new experience, and in fact it was sweltering outside and you walked into the movie theater and it was air-cooled. If you look at pictures in the summertime in the 30s and even the 40s of New York City, you'll see mattresses all over the fire escapes, roofs covered with mattresses. Why is that? Because there was no way to cool down the apartment building. It was swelteringly hot. It was 95 degrees. There was no air. If there was electricity, the fans were almost useless. So people were out there on the fire escape, out there on the roof, everybody sleeping. Nowadays, who could exist? Not only does my place of work, my shul, have to be air-conditioned, my car, chas v'shalom, for me to have to drive in the sweltering heat, without air. Do you know anybody who owns a car without air conditioning? And the truth is that we enjoy luxuries that are remarkable, that not long ago people could not even think about. Another illustration, if you go house shopping and you find a house built in the 30s, you'll probably find a remarkable phenomenon. The hallways may be quite large. The living room, the dining room, very spacious. No matter how large the house is, invariably you'll find that the closets are tiny. Huge master bedroom, tiny little closet. Huge, huge hallways, tiny closet. You know why? Why is it that they built such big houses but such tiny closets? Because the builders in the 30s built houses for the people who were going to live in there. The average man had a suit or two. A woman had a couple of dresses. So they built closets. Why waste good space? They built tiny closets because that's all you needed. How about a woman in our day and age, a third bedroom, where she turns the third bedroom into a closet with one of those dry cleaning racks that goes around? And it's not outrageous, so right? That's what the average person needs, right? But think about it. The amount of clothing that we, regular people, have is astounding. Astounding. Most people are not aware of this fact. Do you know that in Slobodka, which was one of the big shtetls, one of the big towns, actually almost a city in Poland, the average balabos, the average man in shul, did not wear a suit of clothes. Now, maybe you think because they were so modern, they wore sports jackets. No. The average man did not wear a suit of clothes because in Europe, pre-World War II, you got a suit of clothes for a special occasion, like when you got married. And then you got your next suit of clothes when maybe your daughter got married. But there's a lot of time between you getting married and your daughter getting married. So what happens is, typically, you'll start wearing a hole maybe in the jacket over here, so you put on a patch, and then that wears out, you put on another patch, and then you wear a hole over here and wear a hole. After a while, you can't patch the patches together anymore. So you decide to buy a new jacket. But the average person did not have enough money to actually buy a whole new suit of clothes, so you bought either the jacket or the pants. Hence, the average person did not have a suit jacket that was made of the same material as the pants. I mean, who could imagine such poverty, such aeneas. When I was learning in Rochester, my brother was working and he was single, discretionary income. He had a nice job, and he worked in a very fancy industry. I took some of my friends home for Sukkot, and we went downstairs. My brother was living in the basement. We went downstairs. I had to get something from the closet. So I opened my brother's closet. One of my friends was next to me and said, "Wow, I know you guys have a men's suit store in your basement." And he said that because if you looked at my brother's closet, you saw a rack of maybe 15 suits and ties all laid out and shoes. And he thought literally that we had a men's suit store in the basement. But it wasn't. It was just a kid who had enough money to buy himself, you know, a bunch of suits and a bunch of ties, and that's not a big deal. It's not a big deal until you read about people who couldn't even envision such wealth. I hate to date myself over here, but if anyone knows the Fiddler on the Roof, "If I Were a Rich Man," one of the big themes over there was if he was as rich as Rothschild, he would have a new shirt. Like he would change his shirt every day. Do you know little me? I came out a brand new shirt every day, laundered shirt, because it doesn't pay for my wife to clean it, and etc. So I get a almost brand new shirt every day, and after a while, if it's no good, you buy a new one. Something that, again, people of previous generations could not imagine. The Reshiva's Rebbetzin, Aleh Shalom, told me she owned two dresses, a Shabbos dress and a weekday dress, and that was it. Now, gentlemen, I have four daughters. Believe me, they do not own two dresses. I promise you. Closet filled, and I have nothing to wear. But you have racks and racks of clothing. And, of course, it's going to be brown and red, and this season, that season, that's... It's unbelievable. The Rosh Yeshiva grew up in the Depression era in America. And I remember him telling us in Blatche, he told us the following. He said he wore a hole in his pair of shoes. You see, he had a pair of shoes. And he wore a hole in the sole. And the problem was he didn't have the chutzpah to ask his father for the 25 cents that would cost to resole them. So he was a young boy with a hole in his pair of shoes, and every time he'd walk on the concrete, he'd rip his sock on the concrete. He was a clever fellow. What he did was he took a piece of cardboard and put it inside so hence he could walk without rubbing out his sock. Clever, good chap, until he was walking one day in a puddle, splash, end of his new solution. Do you know anybody who owns a pair of shoes? How about blues and browns and blacks and grays? And do you play tennis? Heaven forfend to play tennis in running shoes. Rachamun al-Etzlan. Golf, a whole new wardrobe. You got it. Come on. Get with the program. I mean, this is, you know, we have such wealth, such opulence, that it's almost, if you were to take a person from an earlier generation and bring them into our life now, they would be flabbergasted. They would just be amazed. In fact, I claim, if you would like to go on a spiritual high, and hear good what I'm saying now, if you would like to go on a spiritual high, all you have to do is go to your local Walmart. You'll see 75 feet long, floor-to-ceiling merchandise available in every color, every description, and for the most part, we have enough money to buy it. It's just a question of which color, which style, which week. I was once giving a talk on this subject, and afterwards a woman came over to me and she said that she was involved in helping Russian immigrants settle. And typically what they would do is they would adopt a woman. And she said that recently she adopted this woman and her job was to take her around, to introduce her to America, to the culture, to show her the different places. So she told me that she took this woman to Wegmans. In Rochester, there's this beautiful grocery store, Wegmans. It's a large, beautiful supermarket, and their produce section is magnificent. You see everything laid out with fantastic colors, everything fresh. She said she took this woman into the produce section of Wegmans. The woman looked around, she stared, and she passed out. She fainted, because in all of her life, she had never seen such abundance. Keep in mind, this woman had grown up in communist Russia. In communist Russia in the late 80s, it was commonplace that after a full day of work, you went to stand online for 2 hours to buy a chicken. When bananas came to Russia once a month, the lines were around the block. This woman walked into a grocery store, saw the abundance, the availability, and she fainted because in her wildest dreams, She could not envision such wealth. Available, accessible, right there for anybody to get. And it's eye-opening to think about what it was like living in different times, even in our times, in different cultures. And if you do that a little bit, you get a very clear understanding that we enjoy fantastic, fantastic abundance. By the way, anyone know where the source of buying a chassan, a watch, comes from? Right? Chassan's watch, the gold watch, now the platinum, the diamond studded platinum watch, that's very useful for him every time. I don't know what you do with it, but right? Where did this come from? Now, I've never proven this, but I have a theory, and tell me if I'm not right. I believe it was a very simple thing. In Europe, 100 years ago, a watch was a luxury item. It was a kind of item that you either got at your wedding or you didn't get, because no one had that kind of discretionary income to go buy a watch. So if a family wanted to show the chassan how important he was to them, they showered him with this beautiful thing. Now, in our society, would you like to know where you get a watch now? Ask my children. You open a breakfast cereal box and you'll find a watch inside, because it's almost valueless. So what happened is, in our society, you can't give a chassan a $6.99 Walmart watch, right? So they made up this thing. You make it out of gold and put on diamonds and all kinds of things, because they carry on the custom. But you hear what I'm saying? That item that was a luxury item 100 years ago has almost no value in our times. And to give you an illustration of how far this concept goes, little shade of history here. Anyone know who the King of England was during the Revolutionary War period? Danny?
Henry? George III.
Correct. King George III. Now, why do I care that you know that it's King George III? Because there is a famous portrait of the king, King George III, sitting atop his throne. And what's unique about the picture is you'll see the king on his throne wearing a very thick coat made of pelts. On top of that fur coat is another pelt sort of covering him. And on top of that is some more fur and more fur, and the big bulky king is sitting there on top of his throne. Do you wonder why King George was sitting there with all those pelts on top of his throne? I'll tell you why. Because in Buckingham Palace it was freezing. Why? Because how did you heat up Buckingham Palace? In those days, heat was provided by a fireplace. Now, a fireplace is a real nifty thing. You stand in front of it, so this part of you gets warm. But this part of you is real cold, right? So what do? You turn around, which is great. Now, this part of you is real warm, and this part is real cold. Well, the King of England, with the crown jewels, could not heat his palace. Hence, he sat atop his throne wearing layer after layer after layer, because it was frigid in Buckingham Palace. The King of England walked dank, smelly, dark hallways at night. He climbed into a bed made of down feather. Ooh, sounds geschmack, right? Try sinking into 48 inches of down feather. And there's no chiropractor there to bend you back into shape. The King of England did not have a very comfortable life. And in fact, when the King of England went to visit his cousin, the Duke of York, or went to the wedding, he got into his Royal Highness's carriage. Would you like to know what the suspension system on the royal carriage was? Well, here they are. Wood wheels, metal bar attached to wood wheels to metal pieces. You know what it's like riding on potholes, being pulled by six horses and going and shaking up and down till your insides want to come out? But for how long did the king ride? For a half hour, maybe? Try for 6 days. For 6 days, like a machine, going to go shaking till the insides want to come out. And I'm the royal king in luxuries. I laugh because they used to have the Lincoln Town Car. Used to do a commercial about how smooth the ride is. So originally they tried showing, they tried cutting diamonds in the back. Then they decided to get real fancy. They're going to have a bris mila. And they bring in the moel, and they bring the little baby in the back of the Lincoln Town Car to show you. But gentlemen, understand what I'm saying. Little me rides on an air suspension system. I can actually speak on the phone, enter numbers into my palm, smoothly while I'm driving on the highway. I won't admit to it, but point being, it's a very smooth ride. I am surrounded by six speakers in my air-controlled, air-cooled car. Six speakers, mind you, because I like that symphonic sound. Of course, it was standard with the vehicle. But hear good what I'm saying. All of the symphonies, Beethoven, Bach, were written for princes and kings. They were only played in the king's court, because the only people who were wealthy enough to actually be able to afford that type of luxury entertainment were nobility. Little I pop a CD into my stereo, and I hear music that the kings of England could never envision or imagine. And if I don't like that track, we're on to a new track or a new artist or a whole new... And here's the punchline. Kings of yore could not envision or imagine the luxuries that we have, and the average tax-paying citizen in our society enjoys opulence, wealth, and creature comforts that kings of yesteryears could not begin to think about. And it's eye-opening. Sailors died. Sailors died throughout the medieval times because of what? Scurvy. The only solution to scurvy that was known then was citrus fruit. But citrus fruit was unavailable for 8 months of the year. I can purchase at any time of the year oranges. Now, wait a minute. How do I, living in New York, get to buy oranges any time of the year? Well, the answer is they're imported. From where? From Florida. Even Florida only has a growth season that's limited, right? Don't worry about it. From Chile, from Ecuador, from any part of the world, they're going to make sure that in your supermarket you're going to have peaches, oranges, year-round. Not only do we live in a global financial world, we live in a world where go down the supermarket aisle, not only do you have every product available to you, imported from all parts of the world, things that the richest people of previous generations could imagine. Let me ask the question again. Are you rich? Now, I'll tell you what the problem is. The problem is the definition of rich, and that's the problem. We are culturally brainwashed into accepting that rich has a very limited definition. Rich means I got more than you. Now, if rich means I have more than you, then you're right. Very, very few people are going to be rich, because at the end of the day, no matter how much you got, somebody's going to have more. And you find somebody more than that, and you're always going to be eaten by the bigger fish. And that's a cultural lie that we're brainwashed into thinking. The reality is rich means you have what you need. And surely if you have more than what you need, and if you go down to your pantry and do it every once in a while. Go to your pantry and see a stocked with all kinds of food. You could probably live a month. A good Jewish woman, you probably live for 6 months based on all the spaghettis and the pastas and the... Go down and you'll see. Because we have such opulence, such wealth, such availability of goods. And in fact, the average person living in our society is extraordinarily wealthy. Now, if you take nothing else from this evening other than this one yesod of understanding that perspective is what's going to either make you wealthy or make you poor, that point alone is worth it. Meaning, if your perspective is to be rich, I have to have more money than somebody else, for the rest of your life you're destined to be poor, and even more than that, for the rest of your life you're destined to be miserable. You know why? Because if to be rich means I have to have more than you, then that cuts across every part of my life. To have a nice car, my car has got to be nicer than yours. To have a nice wife, my wife has to be nicer than yours. To have good kids, my kids have got to be better than yours. My business has to be better than yours. If I'm always judging whatever I have based on what you got, I am destined to be miserable. Because no matter what you got in life, there's always going to be somebody who has some element, some feature better than you. So again, if you take nothing else from this evening other than this concept of its perspective and understanding that we have wealth, we have pleasures, we have joys, that is a very important concept. You know, because I taught high school for so long, I almost wait for that line when a guy says, of course listen, I'd be the first one to thank Hashem. If Hashem would give me one thing, if I had one thing in my life, I'd sing Shir of Shevach Hodot to the Borei Olam. But I got nothing. My life stinks. I have nothing to thank Hashem for. So what am I going to thank Hashem for? So again, hearing that line enough times, I almost get used to it. But that's a problem. And it's a very real problem in perspective. And it certainly is going to stop a person from ever being happy. And so the first lesson in being happy, first yesod in being happy, is perspective, understanding. But I have a much bigger fish to fry. And that is an observation to share. This country that we live in was founded on some very great principles. The cardinal principles of the American Constitution are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We now sit here some 228 years after the founding of this nation, and we got it pretty good in two out of three categories. Life, we got it. No question about it. No marauders, no cholera, no black plague. The life expectancy is rising. Fantastic. Liberty, in the history of mankind, never have so many people have so much opportunity. In this land that we live in, opportunity is abundant. You can literally become almost anything you set your mind to. Even anti-Semitism is almost non-existent. You can get into any university, you can get into any trade, you can enter any industry, even if you're Jewish, and oftentimes, even if you're wearing a yarmulke. It's a land of opportunity. So I think in terms of life, in terms of liberty, I think we hit it. It's a third one that's a little tricky, the pursuit of happiness. You got to ask yourself, if you look at the American scene, do you see happy people? And there are many, many ways to cut the statistical evidence. But just look at the faces. Hashem Yerachem, you don't see happy people. Now, as you know, there are literally millions upon millions of antidepressant prescriptions written in this country a year. As you know, suicide is rampant. As you know, it's a society that basically thrives. You want to go into business? I got a good business deal. If you want to go into business in America today, you should become a psychiatrist, psychotherapist, an analyst. You go into anything in the mental health field and you'll make a mint. Why? Because it's a land that's very, very depressed. And I think that's a question that warrants being asked. If we have finally arrived, all that man has yearned for in the millennium is peace, liberty, opportunity, a homeland where you're with secure borders, we have got it. An opportunity to make a living, it's easy as pie. You have so much in terms of material possessions and opulence and wealth. How is it that you're not happy? And that is a very fundamental question. And I'll share with you something that Viktor Frankl writes. Viktor Frankl was a Viennese psychiatrist who wrote a book called Man in Search of Meaning. And the book has two dimensions to it, both of which are worth reading. Viktor Frankl lived through Auschwitz. He was a secular Jew, but he was taken. And the first part of the book, he writes from a psychiatric perspective, analyzing the psychology of inmate life, meaning he steps back and plays psychiatrist, analyzing what it was like living there. Again, a worthwhile read. But it's the second part of the book that I found even more compelling, because the second part of the book, he describes what it was like when he landed on these shores in America and rebuilt his psychiatric practice. Now, he moved into New York City, into the Upper East Side, into a very posh neighborhood. And what he describes is he began seeing things that he had never seen before. People would come into his practice who were very successful, financially successful, socially successful, people who were the pillars of their community. And he would do the normal intake and he would ask, well, have you experienced a recent trauma? No. Your recent divorce? No. Lose a child? No. Bankruptcy? No. What's the problem? DACA, I don't know. But the problem is he describes that patient after patient, he would do the intake, look for all the evidence, look for all the causes, and he would find none. And after this long stream and working with this population long enough, he reaches a very interesting conclusion. His conclusion is that these people, despite their wealth, despite their acceptance to society, despite their being high-powered figures, are depressed because they lack purpose and meaning in life. And in fact, he says, man without purpose, man without meaning will be depressed. Now, it's very interesting that he hit the nail on the head. He doesn't quite understand why, but the reason is quite obvious, because that's what Hashem made us, put us on this planet to do. If you use a tool for a purpose other than its intended purpose, it doesn't function well. Man was created to grow. Man was created to change. Man was created to do significant things. And if you spend your life doing silly, frivolous things, after a while, there's an unrest, there's an unsettling, and you're just not happy. Now, it's kind of sad because the 80s preached materialism. You can get it, you can buy it, you can have it. All you need to be happy is the car, the house, the job, and then you'll be happy. And the American public bought into that image as gullibly as anyone could, and they woke up some 20 years later depressed and broken. Why? Because money don't buy happiness. Honor don't buy happiness. Silly toys do not buy happiness. They have an appeal, they have an attraction, but they leave you empty. And if you do not have a mission, if you don't have a purpose, if you're not here for a reason, and if you're not growing, you will be depressed. And this, for us, is a very, very important yesod. Because you would assume that we, B'nai Torah, should not have a issue with this at all. After all, we got it. We know exactly why we're here. We got the message perfectly. Hashem put on this planet to grow, to accomplish. We have a mission. And you'd assume that within our communities, the concept of depression would be an unheard of thing. We'd be driven. We'd be motivated. And yet, it's not always the case. And gentlemen, you know why? Because I dare say it, it's because we're not quite where we need to be. And I'll cling to one very simple point. Every mitzvah, every one of the 613 mitzvahs focuses around one thing, and that is a human being growing, a person changing, a person reaching a higher level, becoming a more perfect human being, becoming closer to Hashem. That's the focus, the purpose of every mitzvah. And if in fact you're not growing, if in fact you don't have a sense of mission, if you don't have a sense you're on this planet to grow, to accomplish, and you're not doing that, you're going to be lacking something inside, even if you're doing the mitzvahs. And you know something interesting? The pasuk in the Tochacha says, Tachas asher lo avadta Hashem Elokecha b'simcha b'tov levav. Why does the terrible calamities come? Because you didn't serve Hashem b'simcha. It doesn't say because you didn't serve Hashem, because you served Hashem. You're doing the mitzvahs, but you weren't doing them b'simcha. And you know what that means? You see, if you're doing the mitzvahs as external motions that you're going through, there's no sense of empowerment, there's no drive, there's no enthusiasm, because you're robotic. And if you're robotic, you know what you're missing? You're missing the essence of the religion. Because the essence of everything we do is perfection. Self-perfection. Judaism is the ultimate system of self-perfection. That's what the mitzvahs are about. That's what all of what Hashem is about. That's what learning is about. That's what davening is about. It's all about taking me from an imperfect state, bringing me along the path to a more perfect state. Now, if a person gets that, and a person lives with that concept, they live a very, very different type of life than most people do. I want you to imagine the following. Imagine you wake up in the morning, you open your eyes and you say, wow, a day. In front of me is a day that I can grow, I can change. When I put my head back on this pillow this evening, I will be a different person. I will have changed, I will have shaped myself. Could you imagine the sense of empowerment that a person would go through his day with if that was his attitude? And I believe that's exactly what the Tochacha is saying. You know why all of these calamities came? Because you didn't serve Hashem b'simcha b'tov leivav. You didn't serve Hashem with joy, meaning the essence of Avodas Hashem was lacking. It was robotic. You were going through the motions. You didn't even chap what you were doing. You were just minachutz from the outside, but you weren't growing, you weren't steiging, so the essence of it was lacking. And what do you expect? That's what happens. When the essence is lacking, the whole thing falls apart and you have nothing. And it's a very interesting thing that you could be sitting on the edge of the most magnificent present in the world and not even know you got it. You could have the ultimate solution, the ultimate source of happiness at your fingertips. You're going through the motions anyway, and all you got to do is just wake up and it clicks. But if you don't, you go through life sound asleep, sleeping at the switch, not even knowing it. So I think if a person decides that they want to be happy, there are a few things they have to do. The first thing, again, is perspective. Look at your life and study it. Look at previous generations and understand that regular people lived in two rooms. Regular people went to an outhouse. That means in the cold of winter, they donned a coat and walked out to some shack in a freezing cold. That's how regular people lived. Regular people didn't have heating, didn't have air conditioning, didn't have rows and rows of material possessions to buy, didn't have food at their fingertips, didn't have air-conditioned cars and all the luxuries we enjoy. Perspective, thinking, and understanding. And if a person works on that, they wake up in the morning with a sense of richness, a sense of, wow, Hashem, look what I owe you, look what I have, abundance and wealth. This is amazing. And that's one step in being happy. The second step in being happy is a person has to have a good, strong sense of purpose and meaning in their life. And what that means is a person has to know why they're on this planet, what they're here to accomplish, and how to go about it. They have to have a real sense of, I'm here to grow. I'm on this planet for a few short years. I have a mission. Let me accomplish. Let me do. And they have to take on the day, take on life with a drive, with enthusiasm, and understand that all of the mitzvahs do exactly that. But even if a person has the right perspective, and even if a person has a good, strong sense of purpose and meaning, I don't think that guarantees that they'll be happy. I think there's a third ingredient that's necessary for a person to be happy. And that third ingredient was illustrated by something that Abraham Lincoln once said. Abraham Lincoln once said that people are about as happy as they choose to be. And it was some real core truth in what he was saying. What he was saying was that at the end of the day, happiness and being happy is something that you have to choose to do and almost train yourself in doing. And I'll show you an interesting illustration of this. This has been proven in psychological test after test, study after study. If you want to be happy, there's an exercise that will bring you happiness. All you got to do is smile. And they study this time after time. If you get up in the morning and do this weird thing called smiling, and you do it enough times, you do it 10, 15 times, invariably, you're going to be happy. If when you leave your house, you go, hey, Tom, Pete, Bob, Joe, hey, Shmo, and you smile at people, you're going to be happy. Now, Chazal explain it. It's a concept that we're familiar with. It's called chitzonius, external, ma'orus, wake up, pnimius, the internal. The external actions that we do affect our internal moods. So if you smile, even if you don't mean it, if you just do this, it just sort of lifts your spirits, it just sort of lightens you, and against your will, you have more joy in your heart. And if you don't believe me, try it. Try it. Now, I spoke to the women last night, and I cautioned them. I warned them, if you get up in the morning and you practice this, be careful, because your husband may be shocked. And like, what do you want? What do I owe you something? Do you want something? You want a diamond? What's smiling? So be cautious, you know, before you go practice this radical stuff like smiling around the house, around people. You know, you may send some alarm bells off, but try it. Try it tomorrow morning. Just wake up and smile. Try it. Try it for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and you'll find it's a remarkable thing. You just start being happy. And now there's one more step to this. If you attempt this exercise, I'm telling you, I guarantee you, it will bring you happiness. If you wake up and say the following, I will now be happy. But I mean it. If you say, I will now be happy, and you think, I will now be happy. I will be happy. Wow, I'm happy. Baruch Hashem, wow, this is great. I'm really happy. Do you know that you can control your mood? Do you know that you could actually change your mood? Now, don't get me wrong. If your life is out of order, or if you have a chemical imbalance or issues going on, I'm not saying it'll help. But if your life is basically in order, and you have a sense of purpose and meaning, and you're on track, if you do the following, I'm going to be happy, and you think about it, especially if you take stock, look at all the wealth I have, look at my family, and look at the car I have, and look at everything I have, and I have an opportunity to grow, and you actually say to yourself, to be happy, you can control that mood. And with practice, what happens is you find yourself being happier, in a better mood, more often, and it's a great secret that very few people know. And it's kind of sad because everybody's seeking happiness. I did a search on the web with the word happiness. Would you like to know how many millions of websites came up? The solution for happiness, the pill for happiness, the book for happiness, the audio tape. Just send us $59.99 and you'll be happy, right? I know the guy who's getting the $59.99 is going to be happy, but I don't know about you. But ultimately, there is a formula for being happy. And that formula is what Hashem created us to do and what Hashem wants from us. And if a person lives his life on track, if a person is growing, if a person's accomplishing, if a person has a mission, if a person takes his life in perspective, takes his wealth into perspective, and makes that conscious decision to be happy, he will be happy. And gentlemen, this is the big yesod. The big yesod is when you're happy, you know what happens? You have energy, you have koach, you have a drive, you can accomplish 10 times what you couldn't accomplish when you were down and depressed. Because when you wake up in the morning, oh man, another day of life, the grind, you have no coil, you're nothing, you're a zero. If you wake up in the morning with joy, with enthusiasm, you accomplish, you can do amazing amounts of things. And that's what the Tochacha is saying. Because you didn't serve Hashem b'simcha, b'tov levav, with joy, with gladness in his heart, may rove kol from the amazing abundance. Gentlemen, in the history of mankind, never has there been a generation that had abundance as we have now. Never. And I'm afraid there'll be a gevaldige gataina against us if we're not happy. Look what I gave you. A free land, safe borders, health, well-being. There was somebody with a terrorist strike somewhere. What did that have to do with you? You were healthy. You were well. And just one last observation. A friend of mine was on a plane. The plane landed, and because of some technical difficulty in the terminal, they could not taxi the plane over to the terminal gateway. Rather, they parked it off the runway, and they had a mobile gangplank drive up to open. Basically, mobile gangplank was this fellow driving this gangplank. They moved over the stairway to the hatch of the plane. The plane was to open up, and the passengers were to walk down on this. My friend is sitting on the plane. Next to him is a fellow looking out the window, watching this mobile gangplank driving, and he watches the hydraulic lift it up, and then move it over. And he says to my friend, wow, look at the wonders of technology. They have mobile gangplanks. My friend said he wanted to grab the guy. He wanted to say, idiot, we were just flying 20,000 feet in the air, 500 miles an hour, no cables, no wires. Now you're mobile gangplanks. That amazes you. Meaning what? Gentlemen, do you know what we enjoy at a fingertips? You ever stand by a fax machine? Stand by the fax machine tomorrow morning when you're sending electronically this page 6,000 miles away to Eretz Yisrael and say the words, oh, technology is so slow. Darn it, I have to wait. It takes over 7 seconds to scan. Oh my God. My email, unbelievable. It gets jammed and it takes, do you know, AOL takes over 20 minutes to deliver email sometimes? Unbelievable. And the file's too large, too small. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? What I'm saying is when you turn on a radio and you understand that there are no little elves singing in there, but rather radio waves. That means hundreds of miles away, guys broadcasting, and you're enjoying that. And when you plug a, by the way, the next time you plug a light into the socket, say to yourself, where does the power come from? Oh, come on, you don't know, it's electricity. Where is it? It's in the wall. Do you know what electricity is? Well, don't worry about it, because the greatest scientists really don't know what it is. But it's there, and it powers all of our appliances, and we have luxuries at our fingertips that people could not even put a cup of coffee, a cold cup of coffee, in the microwave. Put it in there. Wait 2 minutes, and it comes out steaming hot. If you were to do that 100 years ago, you know what they would have done? Mach Schaefer, Kinshof, your mom is black man. How's it shayach? You take a cold cup of coffee. There's no heat, no fire, and now it comes out hot. They would stone you. They would burn you in the Salem witch trials. Those are the things that are given. Gentlemen, it takes perspective. It takes thinking. If a person thinks about life, thinks about our luxuries, thinks about our wealth, then a person gets his life on track, gets a mission and a purpose, grows, and makes that decision to be happy. In our generation, Meirov Kol will be happy. And ultimately, that's one of the great secrets to be successful, to be productive. May HaKadosh Baruch Hu grant us the wisdom and the koach to understand the bracha that we have and live up to what HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given us in this generation.
You've been listening to The Shmooze, presented by Teferis B'nai Torah. For more information on The Shmooze, please visit us at www.theshmooze.com, where you can download all The Shmoozin' free of charge, as well as view source sheets and address questions or comments on this or any other Shmooze. The Shmooze is completely funded by private donations. We need your help to continue our work. All donations are tax-deductible and count as miser. Please help us help others by calling 866-613-TORAH. That's 866-613-TORAH. Or you can make your donation right on the web at www.theshmooze.com.